Do you believe your grandfather and the other men in your family believe that women were disposable, that they could act in violent and reckless ways because they were rich enough to get away with it?
Oh, absolutely. It's a matter of privilege. It's a matter of being above the law. And those people, they believe that they can't get caught. And when they do get caught, they buy their way out of it. And that's something you learn. You don't just see what's in the current with Army. It goes into the family, and it shows how this all manifested into each generation of abuse. And again, it's horrific, and it's something that I had no one to talk to. And so that's why I want to be an advocate for survivors and victims, because they need a voice. And hopefully, thank you, but they need to know they're not alone, because we all know that abusers want to isolate people and keep them alone. And that's why people don't come forward. It's because they're afraid.
I should make the point that Army Hammer, your nephew, has denied the allegations against him. He says that these were consensual relationships.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of the podcast Crime Analyst. And with me today is
Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer producer of CBS's Criminal Minds, and also involved in Criminal Minds Evolution on right. Paramount Plus. You want me to say that better? Okay. And also, still with Criminal Minds Season 16, Criminal Minds Evolution on Paramount Plus.
And I like the first one, Jim. It had me on the edge of my seat.
And I am Lisa Zambetti, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And we're talking about Army Hammer and this series called House of Hammer. Thank goodness they didn't call it Hammer Time or any other pun on Hammer. It's a docuseries directed by Ellie Hakami and Julian P. Hobbs. And we're going to jump right back in. But I was going to say that we're talking about his behavior and his entitlement. And I just firmly believe, reading about him and looking at the interviews and looking at his career, that his entitlement does not really come from Hollywood. I really believe, because he just wasn't a big enough successful star. And the women who he preyed upon really didn't even know who he was. That's something that, you know, I found out in this documentary. But his entitlement comes from the Hammer family, and we're going to get into that. But let's jump right back in.
Yeah, and I would go back, actually, Lisa, I would say male entitlement, because I think that this is very much about male entitlement and male privilege. But we are going to center the victims first off, and then Jim and I are going to get more into the psychopathology of what's gone on. And it is generation upon generation that we're going to be looking at, but centering and honoring the victims and those who are courageous enough and are able to speak out, because we know that not all have been able to speak out. And with that having been said, we are thinking about Effie, who is not able to speak out because there's an ongoing police investigation. So that's also important, just each episode for us to mention. It's not always possible.
We have to note that Army Hammer has actually denied any criminal activity and any lack of consent in anything that he engaged in with any of these women.
I just need to push back for a second, because this occurred to me as I was watching the documentarians show their texts back and forth, which go from being flirty to being very sexual, with a lot of back and forth between them. And I've started feeling very uncomfortable, because while I know he has accusations of actions that are violent, is there a line between privacy and public lasciviousness? I mean, do we have the right to know about these texts? And aren't we allowed to have fantasies and to share fantasies? And it's not intended to be a reality, that a fantasy command.
If it is, if it stops there, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But clearly the allegations in the show are that it went way beyond fantasy. I mean, the fantasies are bad. If you have fantasies linking sex with violence, it is bad. There is no good of that. There is no, oh, well, it's okay to think about it as long as you don't do it. Because when you masturbate, thinking about these violent sexual fantasies, it reinforces that in your system. It reinforces it. And over time, we see people acting on those fantasies. And that's what turns them on. That's why they act on it. Clearly, all of this was fantasy-based for him. All the allegations were about things that were fantasy-based for him. Because he talked about, in these texts, how much it turned him on when a particular victim was crawling away from him.
Right, later.
For mercy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes,
I just
know.
Mean at the beginning of this, and maybe that's part of his grooming, Laura.
Well, of course,
I don't know. But Jim and I
it
have
is.
A very good friend. You and I, Jim, have a very good friend who is very meek and mild and modest on the outside. And she's a dom, and she's a dom, and she's out about it, and she loves rope play, and I would hate for her to feel shamed. You know,
right.
We don't want people to feel shamed about there are some fetishes that where the person who is submissive is actually the one getting the pleasure and who is actually in control.
But that's if it's consensual. And I think we have to keep dialing it back to if we both agree that we're going to play out this fantasy and I'm the dominant one, you're the submissive, and we've got some rules and we know if it goes too far, that there's a word that's used or whatever you want to put in place, you know, that's fine. It's not about shaming those who have, you know, kinks or healthy sexual behavior and relationships if it's consensual.
Right.
But that's the difference. What he was doing, even from the early days, he was putting them on notice, then withdrawing back, then re-grooming, and then putting them in vulnerable positions, particularly with Courtney, and taking her to the desert, for example. That was part of isolation, and it was part of the whole monopolization of her perception and having her all to himself, where he can start to manipulate and be more powerful with that. And we can't always forget about the power imbalance. That, you know, he takes her in, shows her ropes, so he's trying to expose her to things to see her reaction, then seeing how much more work he has to do
and desensitize her
and desensitizing her. And then when she starts to become more and more emotionally invested, of course she wants to please him. And you feel that you're special, as he said, the bites were badges of honor. You're special, you're the chosen one. And it gradually wears you down when your boundaries are pushed continuously. And that's what he kept doing. It was a push and pull. And he plays a very good game. So I think we have to remember, he didn't go straight in with biting or rope play. He very carefully crafted, because I do believe he's a master manipulator. That's
absolutely
my belief from seeing what he does and how he does it, how he draws you in, how he brainwashes you, how he makes you feel that you're the special one, how he has a script. So, and in the early days, Lisa, he's sharing the gentle things, isn't he? And he's complimenting her and all things that look like romance to her. And then there are these moments, as she says, that were, she doesn't use this word, but there are these moments of jarring, like when she's away from him, her stomach feels knotted. That's a clear sign that you're very uncomfortable, your body is very unhappy with something. But it was a very, you know, it was a slower grooming process with thousands of messages in between. A lot of this stuff was them at a distance. And then when they meet up, he then, over a three-week period of just them being together, you know, the fairy tale is no longer a fairy tale. This picture-perfect guy, she's starting to see the real him.
Right.
So I think that, you know, again, my judgment wasn't actually of Courtney. It was of she knew instinctively, she's got a good head on her shoulders, and instinctively she knew where there were problems. But as women, we're taught to ignore those instincts and to make that other person happy. And to, particularly with a man, we take responsibility for their happiness, and therefore we push ourselves and our thoughts and our needs down because we want to keep the other person happy. And that romance and what's control and what's scary on that line, we can be groomed, the macro grooming and then the micro grooming and re-grooming each time we challenge or question something. And he was very good at doing.
How about he introduces these young women to his mother? I mean, isn't that like ultimate grooming?
Yes, absolutely. Because you believe that now I'm introduced, this is a serious relationship.
I'm important to him. He can't be doing this every week, and he does. But not only that, it also makes him less threatening. Like, oh, this is your mother. I know your mother. You know, you're not going to do something bad to me. You introduced me to your mother. So it's just...
But he made her feel safe. And I thought what was interesting, Jim and Lisa, was that there were moments that she just could not talk about. So whatever has really gone on, it's far worse than, you know, what we understand it to be. And that's from someone who's gone through trauma therapy. That's from somebody who clearly wants to speak out and have her voice because she wants to help other women. But she still didn't feel whatever he did to her was so bad that she can't put words to
it. Can't speak about it, yeah.
Yeah, and that tells us that it's horrific what he's done. And she probably feels the shame, and she feels like she's been duped because she is smart and she did do her due diligence. But with a master manipulator who's really, this is his tradecraft, and perhaps we'll say more about his psychology or his psychopathology, Jim, as we talk through each victim after we've spoken about those who have spoken out, survivors, then we can say a bit more about his psychopathology. But it's much more for me a judgment about him rather than about her or any of the women who fell for his manipulations.
Right. And Laura, one of the things is how he sells things. In other words, he's not saying, I want to do this to you. He's saying, I want to share this with you. I am opening up. I am giving you the insights into who I really am. I am giving you the opportunity to be the one that I share this special thing with. It's turning mud into chocolate. You know, it is not, he's not telling you what he's actually doing, which is I'm trying to coerce you into a situation in which I have complete control over you. You have no consent. You have no power. And no matter what, I'm going to get off on it because you have no power, because you are my good little pet, my own slave. Give me a break.
My personal little slave. Yeah. And the same words being used over and over again. But yes, you are special. I'm inviting you to share this incredible experience with me. I'm opening up your world, which again, for younger women. And Courtney does talk about her age, that she's slightly older, but he was also targeting younger women who aren't as experienced. And there might be a part where you feel that someone is sharing, opening up a different world to experience. And therefore, because there's a power imbalance in age, you might be inclined to trust them more.
Right. It was so sad is that she says, I never said no. It's almost like she was apologizing to the camera that she consented, in inverted commas, because she didn't say no. And it just brings up, that's, I think that's where the documentary is at its finest, is it's bringing up this concept of consent. And hopefully we'll have Joyce Short on. She's written the book, When Yes Means No. And this whole concept of enthusiastic consent, freely given, knowledgeable, informed. You know, it's not just, I tolerated this being done to me means consent.
Let's not forget that if you're tied up and you are exposed and vulnerable, it's very hard to say no. You don't want to upset that person. You don't want to anger them. So actually to vocalize it. And that's what I mean about the power imbalance. And I do think if you look at Biedermann's chart of coercion, I've actually extrapolated. I've got 9 points of that I've added to Biedermann's actually, but the building trust, the isolating, the monopolizing perception, the omnipotence, the degradation and debility and a reward and punishment system and belittling and trivial tasks, but the belittling, the degradation that we heard from Courtney, things that make you feel just, as she said, ugly and full of shame, rules and regulations that are brought in and threats. This is how the coercive control elements work. And that's why I say he's a master manipulator, because even taking Courtney and other women like Paige to the desert, it's isolating them in every sense. It's taking them out of every, under a romantic sort of gesture. But all of those things were things that he used along with saying that this is a badge of honor. You're very lucky to be with me. And of course, Jim, we talked about grooming before you meet the person, i.e. the Epsteins, right. The Michael right. Jacksons. And it's still always in my mind, Epstein with all those naked pictures up his stairwell so that the girls are being desensitized and exposed even. And really, that's what Army Hammer, I believe, he was doing, was constantly trying to desensitize, of doing these things that a red flags, immediate discomfort, and then trying to calm and try and make this to be normal, or if not normal, we're going to share something very special. That theme of always being special, of being picked out, or targeted, as I call it, being targeted.
It goes on and on and on in this. And when we do see Effie and her statement, again, I thought it was with her consent, and I'm pissed that it wasn't, but I'm also glad that I know about it. And it also puts into context when you see his text where he says, raping you on your floor with a knife against you, you crying and screaming and me standing over you. I felt like a god, never felt such power. I mean, to me, that looks kind of like a confession. I mean, it's certainly consistent with what she says. And if that happened, that certainly looks like a crime. And so there'll be an investigation conducted, and if it was a crime, hopefully he will be prosecuted for it. Obviously, he still denies it, but denying it and then saying this kind of stuff, I just don't think those two things are consistent.
Yes, and I've got that bit highlighted as well, Jim. You know, I think that they're really important insights as to what was really going on. When I think about Courtney, he can't even articulate what happened.
Right.
But raping you, you screaming, the knife against you, that's not what most people's fantasies are about. So Lisa, when we go back to fantasies, and you know, the consensual aspect is clearly not here in that. You screaming and crying, I felt like God, that's very clear power and control. That's what the sexual gratification is from. That's the concerning part, the psychopathology regarding him. And we'll talk about him. And what's driving and motivating this behavior, because it is clearly a choice by him. As we all know, there are forums you can go to. There are ways to connect with people who share different fantasies that you may want to play out. Choosing women from a normal pool of, you know, who's on social media, who have not signed up to BDSM, who are not consenting to these things. Why is he choosing these women?
Right.
Don't understand the rules and regulations, that have never been involved in that stuff. And there's plenty of other places he can go where people are clued up and may well want to engage in play, but that's not what he's choosing.
That's not his MO, because that's not what's going to turn him on. What's going to turn him on in this case is women who are not sophisticated in this area, women who he tricks, cajoles, coerces into this kind of behavior, because to him, what turns him on is the fact that they're not actually consenting.
The real fear instead of the play fear.
Exactly. And, you know, if he got off on the play fear, then yeah, there's all sorts of BDSM places that he could go to and sites and so on and so forth. There's another thing in this documentary that kind of bothered me, and we have talked about Gloria Allred before and her history, and she comes out and says that she's a victim's advocate. Gloria Allred, who's the mother of Lisa Bloom, who is also an attorney, and they work together now, and Gloria holds herself out as a victim's advocate, but her daughter, in a very celebrated case, was actually plotting against the victims, the female victims who were sexually assaulted. I don't know if Gloria Allred has ever spoken out about that, or Lisa Bloom has ever publicly apologized for it, but it just bothered me seeing Gloria there, because I don't buy that she is 100% a victim's advocate. She's a lawyer, and she's taking these cases. And she's doing it for a reason.
Well, she didn't have her clients permission to be in this documentary speak on her behalf. No,
Effie's very upset with her too, because she is her attorney and she didn't inform her that she was going to be speaking on the docuseries.
Yeah, so, well, that was another reason why I thought it was legit, was because her lawyer was speaking and I thought she must have approved that. Wow.
No. So, I mean, Gloria Allred says in response to that, that she has to make decisions about what's in her client's best interest. But that having been said, there is, you know, the moral and ethical line where you should inform your client if that's your intention. And I do have huge issues with Lisa Bloom, who seems to have rehabbed her reputation quite well, actually, probably with joining up with Gloria. And I do take issue, given all the correspondence that showed very clearly that she had written to Weinstein, she knew exactly how to take victims down. And I will never forget that. As a victim's advocate, you can't pay me any money to make a
decision.
You would
never say that.
Exactly. And she did. And I don't believe there's ever been a real heartfelt apology. She was apologetic because she got caught out. That's my view on it. But yes, I did feel very uncomfortable reading the Effie again. It's like a double injustice, isn't it? Treble injustice. At the very least, she could have let her know that she was going to speak out in it. Although Gloria does say some powerful things in it. And I think sometimes it is important to have a victim's advocate in there.
Wouldn't be nice to have someone who isn't tainted in that way, let me say.
Yeah, or motivated perhaps by the money and the fame that it brings you. But yes, it's a difficult one. And I don't think, did the documentarians know that Gloria hadn't, got permission from Effie? I even think the title was a bit problematic. House of Hammer and House of Effie. I'm not sure how they arrived. Was it sort of a riff? It feels to me a bit mocking. I don't know why I feel that, but just even the names that, Effie never wanted her. She didn't waive her right to anonymity, but calling it House of Hammer, that felt a bit uncomfortable to me. And that's why, Lisa, I said to you, I wanted to spend a bit of time just reading and analysing this case in a bit more detail, because it's not as simple, really, as it's a three-part docuseries to discuss, is it?
Yeah, and we've really just focused on the Armie Hammer of it all, and there's so much more to the documentary that I think is really worth people to watch.
I think it's an important part in our first episode just to say that Armie Hammer was married to Elizabeth Chambers for 10 years. And she's formerly a journalist for E! And a feminist. And I think it's interesting that just before he was embroiled in all the allegations coming out, that she took a decision, it sounds to me, to end the relationship. She filed for divorce, citing irreconcilable differences. Now, I don't know what really went on there, but it seems to me that the things may well have been connected. And of course, I'm always very interested in what a woman who's had a relationship with someone like him might say about what's gone on behind the scenes. Because there's the whole question mark about who is the true Armie Hammer. And Jim and I are going to peel back some of those layers in the next episode. But I think the fact that he does have two children who seem to me that he never bore any consideration to them when he was acting like this, of what kind of role model he wants to be to them when he's treating women this way, that's been disclosed. But I do wonder what was going on behind closed doors and why she took the decision to file for divorce, citing irreconcilable differences, particularly as she's a feminist. And she did make a statement on Instagram saying that she was shocked. In fact, she basically said this: "For weeks, I've been trying to process everything that has transpired. I'm shocked, heartbroken, and devastated. Heartbreak aside, I am listening and will continue to listen and educate myself on these delicate matters. I didn't realize how much I didn't know. My sole focus and attention will continue to be on our children, on my work, and on healing during this incredibly difficult time. Thank you for all the love and support, and thank you in advance for your continued kindness, respect, and consideration of our children and me as we find ways to move forward." No mention of those women who may well have been victimized, which I think is an oversight there.
Right. Well, I think that was probably too hot button a subject, because then she would have to deal with the fact of when these things went on. Was he still married to her? But also that whole history, he said, if I'm not mistaken, didn't he make a statement that, yeah, he does this. He would never do this kind of thing with his wife because he respects her too much.
Something yes. Like that. Yes. I remember a statement like that.
Right. So doesn't that show that he disrespects all these other women that he's doing it to? I mean, he's admitting that it's sheer disrespect.
Well, I think it's an interesting thing, Jim, that in our next episodes, we can start to peel back the layers on. Because for me, it's not about blaming Elizabeth Chambers. It's not about saying, well, you know, what was he doing with his wife? But it does say a lot about him. If there were no behaviors like this within their relationship, of how he views women and why potentially he wants to harm women and hurt women and humiliate women, and why inflicting pain is something that he enjoys on women. But it's something we can talk about more in the next episode, because who is the real Armie Hammer is the question mark, isn't it? If he can behave in one relationship a certain way, but outside of that, he behaves very differently. And then we understand everything about his background in the next episodes of the docuseries. And we're going to peel back the layers on the men in the Hammer family, because that is something that is relevant. And we do see patterns repeat. And Jim and I are always very interested in patterns and red flag behaviors.
Yes. Absolutely. We want to thank everybody for listening. Until next time, this is Real Crime Profile signing off.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.